and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I am your under the weather host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hi.
I am my voice is fighting me. My throat has become my enemy. My lungs are trying to suffocate me from inside, Tim. So this show could go any way. It could be a true crime unfolding right in front of us, as I'm pretty sure my body is attempting to murder me. I could be wrong. I don't know. You know, it's man flu, Tim. You understand the elevated concern when man flu is involved.
Yeah, I guess so. Sure.
What? Tim, it's a dangerous, dangerous thing. Don't leave me hanging, twisting in the wind like this. We're men. We have to side with one another in this.
Ah, I see. Yeah.
Yeah, not so much, huh? Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it. Yeah. Hey, listen, we're going to get started with today's show. I got to ask you. All right. Now, I know that you've thought about starting a family. And would you ever consider adoption, Tim?
Yeah, I believe I would. Sure.
Yeah, I've got a bunch I'll drop off tomorrow.
No, none of yours. I just said I'd consider adoption.
Oh, I see how it is.
I know what I'm getting there.
Like you, there are millions of couples around the world that are looking to make their family bigger mm-hmm. and make it a little better mm-hmm. and open their hearts to children mm-hmm. that are in need that they could bring in and give them a new life. Mm-hmm. And there are so many children out there that need that. Children that are part of the foster system. Mm-hmm. Children whose parents have passed away unexpectedly or perhaps have been involved in different cultures of drugs and crime that they really need the break. But what happens, Tim, when you find out that the child that you adopted didn't come from that background at all? What if you found out that the child that you adopted was actually stolen? Hmm. Now, would you ever be desperate enough in the adoption process? I'm just curious if you thought, even in the slightest way, that maybe this child was coming to you in maybe not such an open, honest way. Do you think just the concept of wanting and desiring that child so bad, you'd be willing to look the other way?
Boy, it'd be tough if it were something where I got to know the child after a while, like in a foster situation where you'd had the child for a few months and you'd really fallen in love with the child. It'd be tough to want to give that child up. If it were something where you hardly knew the child, I would think you'd have to do the right thing and turn the child back.
Right, but I'm saying if you were trying to adopt and mm-hmm. maybe, just maybe, your radar pinged, you weren't positive, but you had a feeling that maybe the person helping you with this adoption might not be on the up and up. Would you follow through anyway to complete that part of your family, that part of your life? That's a tough call, isn't it?
I mean, it can be. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that's what we're going to discuss today, the Children's Home Society. It permanently changed the lives of more than 5,000 children, Tim. Hmm. 5,000 children were affected by this. And there's a book out, and it's available. It came out in October called Before and After, The Incredible Real-Life Stories of Orphans Who Survived the Tennessee Children's Home Society. Joining us today is one of the authors of that book, Judy Christie. She's an award-winning journalist and the author of 18 books of both fiction and nonfiction, and a former editor at daily newspapers in Tennessee, Louisiana, Florida, and Indiana. She holds a master's degree in literature from Louisiana State University in Shreveport, and she and her husband live in rural Colorado. She's here to talk to us about this unbelievable story. Judy, thank you so much for coming on and opening up about this with us today.
Thank you all so much for having me. This is a topic that I have researched a lot, especially in the last year, and I really like to talk about it and to make sure people are aware of it. It is sort of the ultimate true crime story.
Well, and this is this is still a mystery that's unfolding right now, correct?
That's right. It absolutely is. In fact, we continue. Lisa Wingate is my co-author, and she and I continue to hear from people who want information about their birth families, about their backstories. We hear from people who have read before and after. I just got a great email last night from a woman who's in her 80s. She lives in Tennessee, and she's what is called a Georgia Tan baby, a baby who was adopted through the Tennessee Children's Home Society in Memphis. And she told me, she said, this book was so therapeutic for me. And her daughter emailed me this morning to say, my mother has never before been able to read or know about other people who went through what she did until she read Before and After. It really is unfolding.
For 20 years, a Tennessee baby thief kidnapped more than 5,000 children from the streets, hospitals, and shanty towns of Memphis. How is that possible? 5,000 children. How could this go on undetected for so long?
You know, I think one thing that happened was that Georgia Tan built a power system, and people who have power learn how to use it. And so law enforcement, judges, attorneys, physicians, they would look the other way. And one thing that has really come to me in recent months is that many, many powerful people adopted these children. And it's exactly what you were talking about with Tim as you opened the show. These children were theirs then, and they did not want to risk, they didn't want to rock the boat and risk having to lose their child. It really is shocking. And when somebody would begin to kind of sniff around and try to ferret out the truth, Georgia Tan would really criminally shut them down. Like, here's an example. A judge in Memphis, he began to realize that something was going on that was not right. So he said, I will only sign adoption papers for children who I've identified the birth parent and the adoptive parents. And so when Georgia Tan heard that, she just moved the court cases out into the region in Tennessee, into these small town, small rural county courthouses, and began to process them through there, and people would do it. Money is a mighty fine motivator in crime, as you know.
Oh, it certainly is. And it's amazing what people are willing to do for it and to what lengths they'll go. Let's go back to the beginning then, if you don't mind. From the 20s to the 50s, is that about the right time era? Is that when this Georgia Tan ran a black market baby business?
That's exactly right. It was 1924 to 1950. And she actually started over in Mississippi. She was the daughter of a prominent judge, and she got into this business, and she was actually run out of Mississippi because they did not approve of her practices. So she just came right over the border into the state line, into Memphis, and started there. So 1924 to 1950.
Well, when they weren't pleased with her practices, what were the practices that she was involved in at that point?
I think they were similar. She was getting babies and placing them in homes without vetting the homes. That's one of the big things that she did was even, you know, when she wanted to provide babies to certain kinds of people, especially wealthy people, famous people, people with power, that helped her build her base. And so once that she started doing that, she would not really go in like you were talking. If Tim wanted to, say, adopt a child, well, somebody would come in, they would inspect his home, they would talk to him, they would do a background check, they'd probably interview you. Well, Georgia Tan didn't do any of that. It was horrible. She would just, if you had a certain amount of money and or a certain amount of leverage in the world, in politics, entertainment, all sorts of things like that, she was willing to place a baby in your home.
All right. So Dave Schrader, Darkness Radio, True Crime Tuesday. I really want to adopt a child. I really George, I really am looking for a baby, and I'd like a light-skinned baby, maybe a baby with blue eyes and blonde hair. Would it be that specific?
Absolutely. It was like inventory. I'm telling you, Dave, she would, in fact, she even ran ads in the Memphis newspaper that said, give a baby as a Christmas gift. And she liked blonde haired, blue eyed babies. They were by far the most popular. She also, though, your babies had to be attractive. Like one of the people in the book who is profiled in Before and After, she was what she calls an ugly baby, and she was left in a corner crib to die. Her parents came in to adopt another baby, and Georgia Tan met the parents in the orphanage, and she had this baby boy. She said, here you go. Here's your son. Every man wants a son. He's so healthy. Well, the father heard this weird noise from the corner, and he said, what is that? Georgia Tan was so irritated. You did not cross Georgia Tan. And she said, it's nothing. Here's your fine baby boy. So he goes over to the corner, much to Georgia Tan's. She was very angry. And he sees this pitiful little baby there, underweight. She's got a rash. Her tongue is tied. And she is just at death's door. And it's a little girl. And he says, we'll take this one. And they saved that little girl's life. She is now in her mid-70s, and she says, Georgia Tan left me there to die, and I'm 74, and I'm still alive.
Good God. So she would even acquire babies, and if they weren't up to snuff, if they were scratch and dent models, she would let them die?
Yes, in fact, at least it is estimated 500 babies died in her care. And the way this happened, and it may have actually been more, is that one, if she didn't think you were good inventory, that you weren't going to move out for a certain amount of money because she wanted to make as much as she could. And she never charged for the babies. What she charged for were handling fees. And that's how she got around the whole I'm selling babies thing. It only cost $7, by the way, in those days to adopt a baby in Tennessee. And so she might charge someone $1,000 or $2,000 or even $10,000. And that's how she made her money. And so sometimes she would not care for babies, particularly if they weren't ones that were going to, quote, move quickly. She also, there was a terrible influenza epidemic, and a pediatrician said, you cannot keep that many children in that orphanage. They're going to die. And a lot of children died, and there was an inquiry, and the law was changed so that you couldn't keep so many children in a facility. But guess what? Georgia Tan's facility was exempt from the law.
So Georgia Tan, is kind of run out of one place. She starts over in another. Where is she acquiring these children? I mean, is she just going into hospitals? And believe it or not, folks, up until even 10, 15 years ago, there was very lax policy about allowing parents or other people into the birthing wards. And because there would be so many friends and family and neighbors coming in and out to visit and going to see the babies, it was very hard for them to do it. Now, in the advent of the last 15 years, the baby gets a wristband, you get a wristband. Everybody's got to match and make sure that everything is done right and properly before you're allowed to leave the hospital with these children as well. But was she the one specifically doing this, or did she have a ring of thieves she worked with?
Well, both, actually, Dave. One thing she would do is she drove was driven around West Tennessee and into Arkansas in a big black limousine. And she would kind of glide around, and she would find poor children who had either been left alone without a babysitter or, you know, all sorts of circumstances, and she would pick them up. And I can, in our book, Before and After, Lisa and I talk about a couple of kids who were just picked up just like that. She also had a network of physicians and clinics so that she would, you know, people would let her know. So once you got on her radar, your family was likely in her line of fire. And there's a story in our book. So these people I love, and they are really heroes. I'm telling you, the ones that we profiled, they have really overcome. They have found their siblings in many cases. It really is heartwarming how they've lived their lives. And I just absolutely love them. So here's an example. One thing is a lot of this happened in the wake of the Depression. Some of it happened in conjunction with World War II. Some of it happened with people who were living so poor in the South, and they couldn't perhaps take care of a baby, or, you know, what you were talking about the hospital wards. Everything was different. You didn't keep maybe quite such a close eye on your child as you do now. In the hospital wards, she would have nurses and others who would help her, and she would say that babies died. And one of the stories in the book, a man who came, just showed up at the Memphis Library when we were there having a book event last summer. He told me this amazing story, very tragic. His mother had had one baby, a toddler, and she was pregnant, and she went to the hospital. His dad was at work, and it took him a while to get there. You know, that was pre-cell phone, pre-everybody having a car. And he saw the baby. It was a son. The baby was very healthy, crying, lusty, you know, lustily. And then the mother was told that the baby died overnight. And these were uneducated people who lived in rural Mississippi. They lived right over the river. And so they were told that their son died, and if they would sign these papers, that the hospital would take care of everything, the burial, you know, all of that. Well, they just signed. The mother was still in a fog from the anesthesia. And so they went home, and then the more they thought about it, they had never heard of Georgia Tan. Nobody at that point knew. And they just thought, this is not right. And the mother remembered hearing other women, you know, in those days you had curtains between the beds in this delivery ward. And she remembered hearing other mothers being told that their babies had died too. So that was one way she got babies. And that's a really sad story. The book has a lot of, I think, very uplifting stories. But this one haunts me because the man I interviewed, he was born later, and his mother would not even go to the hospital to have him. She had him at home because she was so afraid of what could happen to him if she went to the hospital. And he never knew any of this until his mother was dying a few years ago, and she finally told him about it, and he promised her that he would search for this lost brother. And he has found a death certificate, which is clearly not accurate. It has the wrong date. It has all sorts of details wrong. So that's an example of it.
You know what? Okay. You can understand, and I mean this in the loosest form, you can understand one or evil person like Georgia Tan coming up with this, but then to find people complicit in her actions. Doctors, nurses, hospitals, administrators, people that are willing to steal these babies for her. I think that might be one of the most terrifying aspects of this story to me, is how many people were willing to participate in something like this. Were they targeting specific types of people? Were they targeting the ones that they knew might struggle to take care of these children? Were they targeting alcoholics or drug addicts, prostitutes, something that at least you could see, maybe she really had the intention of giving this baby a better life than what it would have had.
Right. Well, she targeted poor people who were uneducated and did not have resources to fight her. And I really believe, Dave, that she had a God complex and thought that she knew better where these children should be. And then probably, it quickly escalated and was tied in with a profit motive. But, you know, there were a lot of very fine people who had children, very poor. I mean, I was born in rural Arkansas to very poor parents, and my parents did a great job raising me. But, you know, just because you don't have money, and that's one of the things that is so hard here, is it people, if they tried to fight her, they lost. And there are so many examples in our book of before and after where people would find out, for example, there's a wonderful woman who lives in Alabama who I interviewed. She and her brothers were actually abandoned by their mother on some courthouse steps in rural Tennessee. And Georgia Tan, you know, found out about it, and this woman feels certain it was through local law enforcement. So the big black limousine pulls up, says, you know, come on, children, I'm going to take you to a better place. And what she does, this woman is who's now in her 70s. She is very close, was very close to her little brothers. And when they get in the car, she says they'll all be going together. And So the mother was poor, ignorant, had a boyfriend, couldn't take care of her kids. It was sort of one of those where she had three kids and one egg to feed them. And so she leaves them there, and they're taken by Georgia Tan. But the ugly thing that happens is that Georgia Tan didn't rescue them with the purest motives. She separated them. She sent the two boys to another facility, and it, without telling the little girl, it was a very horrible thing. This was something she regularly did, was separate brothers and sisters, little brothers and sisters. And so the grandfather finds out what this mother has done and is very upset, goes to the orphanage, and this is all in our book before and after, and goes to the orphanage to get this little girl, and is told that she has already been adopted, even though she was under the weather and was actually right upstairs. So there's so many stories like that. There's another story. This is one talking about what your question, or addressing maybe a little better your question. A man in right after the Depression, dirt poor, he leaves his family with some money, and he goes up and gets a job at a factory up in West Virginia, I believe. And his family struggles, and eventually they decide they're going to go. His wife and kids are going to go up and connect with him. But his wife gets part way up there, runs out of money, and puts the children in a place called the Blount County Industrial Home, which was a true, you know, county facility there in Tennessee. And she says she paid their board, their room and board. And but they loved these children. There's a lot of original paperwork that still exists, and I was able to do a lot of research and see this original paperwork. They love these kids. They think, they describe them like they are, you know, this year's hottest Christmas toys. And so they put them up for adoption. Well, the father and the mother connect. The father is quite upset, and he comes down to try to get them. He can't. They are just poor as can be, and they live in basically a shanty near the mill. And he comes down, they use all their money to get a lawyer. They find two of the children, they never find the third one. And by the time, this kind of goes to what you were talking about at the opening, by the time they wind up, they find the other two down in Memphis. So much time has gone by. It's been about 2 years that these little kids hardly know them. And the judge doesn't let the kids go with these parents. I mean, that.
What?
Yeah, this is an example. And I have that lawsuit. And this man, the grandson of this man who fought for his kids, and he's an example. Oh, it looks like something out of one of those, you know, Norman Rockwell paintings of the man after the Depression. That's what this guy looked like. So his grandson came to see us, Lisa and I, at the library in Memphis. And he said, the only reason I'm here is I don't want anything like this to ever happen again. Children should not ever be taken from their parents because the parents are poor. And he said, you know, we just have to take care of children and never let this happen again. And that was his only reason for telling his story. He came in with all the documents, the legal case, the court filings, the judge's rulings, newspaper clippings. Yeah. So that's, you know, poor people had, it was very hard for them to fight, you know, fight the system.
So she would, and as I understand this as well, Georgia would, she would drive this luxury car of hers, this fancy, shiny black car. She would see these pretty little kids. She would offer them a ride, and then they would never see their families again.
That's right. And she would split up siblings.
Wouldn't the children say that to the adoptive parents? You know, this lady stole me, you know, was taken away. What? How did that part of the story, you know, baby has no clue. Children know who their parents are, know that things aren't right.
That's a great question. So what she did was insidious. She separated, as I mentioned, siblings. So that was the first step. Secondly, she changed their names. And that to me, this is one of the heartbreaking things of this. You know, a lot of these people, the people I interviewed and Lisa interviewed in before and after, a lot of them were given family names at birth. And then as soon as they got into Georgia Tan's clutches, they got new names. She falsified all sorts of records till the paper trail is so confusing. And people still are trying. I mean, you know, people in their 80s are still trying to sort out who really was my birth father. And so she would change names. She would falsify dates. She would change places. And then if somebody came to her, which this did happen, and said, oh, you know, little Johnny says he's got a sister, she would say, oh, he's confused. He was in the orphanage and he just got confused. And there, so here's the story I just told you about the woman who was abandoned on the courthouse steps with her two brothers. Her two brothers talked about her so much to their new parents, who didn't really understand what they were talking about, that their new adoptive parents adopted a baby sister for them because they kept talking about a baby sister that they actually already had. And well, here's one of the stories in the book that four sisters who are just lovely women, live all over the country, came to a gathering we had last summer, summer of 2018 in Memphis, Lisa Wingate and I. We got together with some of the adoptees and their family members. And this was right when we were beginning to think we need to preserve these stories so that, you know, so many people hear about Georgia Tan, but they don't know these true stories of these remarkable people who survived. And so these four women came, these sisters, and they began to tell us their story. They brought with them their mother's ashes to sprinkle in the Mississippi River to bring her back home. And it was really an emotional gathering, as you might imagine. So here's what happened to their mother. Their mother had a twin sister, and they were actually almost 8 years old. And that she also had a couple of other siblings. The mother got into a domestic dispute with their father and got a boyfriend and had to go to the hospital. While she was at the hospital, Georgia Tan pulls up. And they say, do you want to go for a ride? These kids were truly what would be in that age, they were called river rats. They lived in a shanty there on the river. And they had never even seen a car. So they got in the car and they go, and Georgia Tan promptly changes the age of the twins to 6 years old and puts them on a train and sends them to Pennsylvania, where they were adopted. There was a woman waiting for them who wanted a child desperately. I mean, that's the other side of this. And she was waiting. She was a school teacher. And when they got off the train, she said, hi, I'm your new mama. And these four women who we met, their mother said, you're not my mama. And that basically characterized her life forever. She fought and had a very angry and ugly life. And actually, only through this process of this book and my co-author's novel, which is Before We Were Yours, have these four women, they really have forgiven their mother. Like I say, they brought her ashes down and sprinkled them in the river. And they really said, Mom, we hope you're at peace now. So that's an example. You know, people just wouldn't listen to the kids.
I can't even imagine. I mean, between my wife and I, we have 11 children. I can't imagine losing one of them. But to know that so many children were taken, groups, and then split up. And the woman that adopted these kids that said, you're not our mom. What was her reaction? Did she press on? Did she ask questions? How did she deal with this? Or was it that she was thinking, oh, these kids are just dealing and suffering with the loss of their parents?
I think that's basically the approach she took. And so these two, you know, these twins, I think, you know, they're a fascinating example. One of them, the one whose daughters I interviewed, she fought her entire life. The other one accepted it and, you know, went on to just try to accept that life and didn't fight it. And it's really hard, you know, like Lisa said this to me once. So just as a minor aside, so my co-author, Lisa Wingate, is a novelist, and she wrote a historical novel where she did a ton of research on this. And she saw it on a documentary late at night, the true story of this. So she wrote a novel about it, and it was called Before We Were Yours. It came out in 2017. And that novel just struck a chord with people. And she began to hear from adoptees who said, oh my gosh, that's my story. I never knew. And so it really, people, one thing that Lisa said, and this is really painful to think about, you had these parents who wanted to adopt, who were so eager for a child, and for a lot of reasons, they could not adopt. The people who Georgia Tan dealt with could not adopt conventionally, by and large. They were too old in many cases. Many of these parents are older. Some of them were divorced, which in that era, divorced people were not given children. Some of them were in families of mixed religions, like maybe one person was Jewish and one person went to the Episcopal Church, and that you couldn't adopt. There were a lot of Jewish families who adopted babies through Georgia Tan who could not adopt otherwise because of anti-Semitism. So you think about these people, Dave, who wanted these babies so desperately and who wanted to give them a good life. And so I feel like that some of the people, like this woman who met, you know, the twins at the train, she didn't know they had been stolen out of someone's yard. And she just wanted to make a good life for them. I don't think most of the parents, in fact, I haven't found any parents who knew what Georgia Tan was doing until the scandal broke.
Oh, now, these babies that she would take that she found flawed, that she refused to put out there, what would she do with them? I mean, was she hiding the bodies? Walk us through that.
Well, that is something that is somewhat still a mystery, although many people in the Memphis area have opinions on this, and some people say these things as fact. I don't know these things for fact, but I do know generally what happened. One is, it is clear that children in the Tennessee Children's Home Society in Memphis died there of illnesses. So either it was too close proximity to other children who were ill, or they weren't properly cared for. Also, there, you know, is Lisa in her research has uncovered stories of Georgia Tan sort of discreetly giving people out in the area these bodies to get rid of. And there are a lot of kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't even call them myths, but there certainly are rumors that bodies are buried in various places. But the one thing, she did account for only 19 babies who died, even though it is documented the number was way higher. And 19 were buried in an unmarked grave at a cemetery, a beautiful historic cemetery in Memphis called Elmwood Cemetery. They were buried there in an unmarked grave. And a few years ago, a volunteer at the museum said, we must put a marker up. And various people donated money. One woman in particular donated most of the money for the marker because she had lost a child at birth. And it was, she wasn't a Georgia Tan baby, but she wanted to remember her child. And so there is a marker there that says, you know, to these so that, that this may never happen again. And we gathered with adoptees and family members, and I get chills just talking about this there. And, you know, the woman I told you about who was in the corner left to die, and she went to the cemetery, even though she's lived in Memphis her entire life, she went to the cemetery for the first time. And she said, if it weren't for my father, I would be in that grave. So, you know, a lot of them, who knows where they wound up? Bodies, I mean.
Yeah, that's... unbelievable. Now, her client base, the people that were purchasing buying these babies, mm-hmm. a wide spectrum. Now, as I understand this, she serviced some major celebrities as well.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. She loved Hollywood. She liked Hollywood, and she liked to deal with movie stars and people out there who had money. And she actually flew out to California fairly regularly over a period of time. Now, at other times, she would send someone who she called a nurse, although almost everyone believes it wasn't truly a nurse. It was just someone in a nurse's uniform. And somebody might take, you know, five or six babies out there and deliver them. And I've interviewed multiple people who were dropped off in California, you know, flown overnight, dropped off at a usually either at a particular train station or at a fancy hotel, and the nurse, you know, their parents take them, their new parents, and the nurse sort of disappears, and that's that. But yeah, so, you know, one of the people I interviewed in the book is actually he is the son of a really famous cowboy actor and singer. And so that his name, the actor and singer's name was Smiley Burnett, and people of an era will know him. And he was the sidekick to the famous cowboy Gene Autry. Well, Smiley liked Georgia Tan a lot. He was in Memphis a lot because he performed there. And he and his wife, Dallas, they adopted four children through the Tennessee Children's Home Society. And I interviewed his son, who lives in Tennessee still, who has moved back to Tennessee. He lived for many years in California. Now, these people, you know, they were very well off. They, you know, let's put it this way. Ronald Reagan was the best man at Smiley Burnett's wedding when he eloped. And so they, I don't believe, I think they really adopted these children with the best intentions and the best motives. And I don't think they ever knew, and you know, until the scandal broke, what Tan had done. And so Georgia Tan came and stayed in their home frequently when she would bring a child out to California, to Hollywood. She would stay with them. And so they had these four children. And then weirdly, down the street from them were some people who wanted to adopt a child, and they would tell people about Georgia Tan. I mean, they really, you know, hey, I can help connect you with this woman. And so I interviewed a man. Oh, he's such a delightful man. He lives in Utah, and he is not in all that great of health. He's in his 70s. And his daughter has really helped him find his family, and that might be something we can talk about. It's just how these people, you know, find families through really hard circumstances. And his parents found out about Georgia Tan through Smiley Burnett, and he was adopted through Georgia Tan. And so, yeah, it's she liked movie stars. You know, Joan Crawford did actually adopted a couple of kids from there.
Joan Crawford. Well, her original kids, Christina, is that one of the kids she adopted through Georgia Tan? Okay, so it was that second wave.
Right. Because
she had the two kids, then they grew up a little bit, and she adopted more.
Right, right. And the other one,
Georgia Tan.
Right. And also Ronald Reagan adopted a child from there. You know, when I was talking to people, they would say, well, have you talked to Roy Rogers? And I'm like, are Roy Rogers people? I was like, no. And then like, Lehman, who founded Lehman Brothers as governor of New York, he was adopted from there. A lot of prominent people came through there. And
I wonder if, like, I know Jimmy Cagney adopted, I think, two kids. There were a lot of prominent actors and actresses at that time. They didn't want to ruin their shape, so a lot of the women wanted to adopt. Some of the men were incapable of producing offspring, so they would adopt. It makes you wonder how deep the tendrils go. Did she keep pretty comprehensive records of all the celebrities that she helped fulfill their requests?
She kept good records. This is kind of, to me, it's a paradox. In some ways, she falsified every record. In other ways, there are amazing details that are still available. And a lot of records were apparently destroyed when a governor's report came out that showed her evil and what she had done, which is another story of how justice has really never been done, in my opinion, in this case. But she would. So there are a lot of records, but she valued people's privacy. And in a way, some people, the letters they wrote her almost seemed like they felt like they were being blackmailed, that if they didn't, you know, send money or whatever, she might out them. Now, Smiley Burnett was very proud of his adoptions, and you can go online and listen to some of his old radio shows and performances where he talks about his children. And Stephen, his son, says that his dad talked in part about the kids because he never wanted to be blackmailed that they were adopted, you know. And so, you know, adoption had back. This is another one of those paradoxes. Really, Georgia Tan helped kind of popularize adoption, which did carry a little bit of a stigma back in an earlier era.
Well, right. Nobody wanted to feel like they weren't virile enough to have a baby. Right?
Oh, yeah. Right. And mothers, the adoptive mothers, once they got a child, they never wanted the word adoption mentioned. This is a thread that runs through almost everyone I've interviewed. And I have to tell you that, that the mothers would, you know, they just wanted to be like, this is my child and let's not ever speak of that. And so that there was kind of a cloak of mystery and secrecy, and secrets have a way of coming out, and people found out in really odd ways. Like one man I interviewed who is such a nice man, and he spent years, his wife really found his family back before the internet and before DNA was really as popular as it is now. His wife just called and called and called all over, anywhere she had a clue. She found his family, but let's see, what was I going to tell you about? Oh, he found out his he was at a funeral for his adopted grandmother. He didn't know he was adopted. And he picked up a family Bible. He was 16 years old at this funeral, and he saw a notation that he was adopted. And so, you know, secrets come out one way or the other.
Now, these families that started trying to piece back their families together, how, you know, before the advent of, you know, 21andMe or whatever the hell it's called, and Ancestry.com and Google and the internet, how were people figuring this out and even connecting?
Well, it was very difficult. One thing I love about these people, who the youngest person I interviewed was born in 1950. So I interviewed people who at the time, so 69 to the oldest was 86. These people are heroes. I'm telling you, they were persistent, many of them. They ran ads in newspapers. Hey, I'm looking for somebody in this family. They wrote letters. They called. They would call people and say, like, you know, is your daughter adopted? And but they really persisted. And there was a wonderful woman in Memphis. Her name was Denny Glad, and she became a crusader to help people before records were opened and before the internet. And she and a group of volunteers went around to courthouses in West Tennessee and took notes and pieced together a lot of these stories. Now, she has died, but before she died, she had a tremendous impact on helping people. Then she really helped get the Tennessee law changed, where these people, these Tennessee Children's Home Society babies, could see their records. And, you know, they make very, very compelling arguments, you know, now in their 70s and 80s, saying, I deserve to know who my birth mother was. And, you know, I just interviewed a man, this man, and he is very open about this. His name, his real name is Matt Lucas. He's in the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. He's a delightful musician. He's in his 80s. And he told me he was adopted by a family in Nebraska, in Omaha, and he has not known about his birth family, and he's really been searching in recent years. And he told me recently that he really would like to be buried at the foot of his adoptive mother's grave. He has a plot there, but he would really like to know where his birth mother's grave is. Isn't that something? And he's in his 80s.
Oof. It's beautiful that somebody like that is caring enough to want to look.
Mm-hmm.
It's out there still doing that. That's great.
And Ancestry has now helped a lot.
I bet. Well, let's go back to Georgia Tan. I mean, she's running this very successful business for 20 some years. How, you know, I mean, everybody in business, no matter how good a boss you are, you piss off your employees from time to time. And how does she keep everybody quiet and in line? Or is everybody so afraid that because they've been complicit, that if they say anything, they may end up in jail?
I think she was a very scary woman. She's a formidable looking woman when you see historic pictures of her. People said that she was, when she was in the orphanage, I interviewed one woman who can actually remember as a young girl. She's the only person I have interviewed who remembers Georgia Tan. And she said when she was in the building, the whole atmosphere was different. I also suspect exactly what you said, Dave, that she, Georgia Tan, you know, basically blackmail people that if you were to tell what was going on, you would be part of it and you would be in trouble. And yeah, so that's, you know, I think part of it. She made so much money. I figured this up. Now, I got to say, you know, a lot of people will, even the people whose lives were in so many ways affected by her, will say, well, I was raised by good people. I had a better life. Like Smiley Burnett's son, it says, you know, she gave me, Georgia Tan gave me a much better life. But, and so there, you know, there is that. But I think that, I don't know, it confounds me in a way. She may, well, I was thinking about him and different people and what they say about her. But what I wanted to say was, so this man, Mr. Burnett, says, well, she didn't steal babies. She charged fees for them to be delivered and so forth, which was true. But then, as I said, she double dipped. And I have a lot of letters, by the way, that people have given me in my research where she says, make the check out to Georgia Tan personally and put in the memo line, transportation. And so I figured up, but in the last 10 years alone, 1940 to 1950, in today's dollars, Dave, she made $10 million.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. So she, good God, she's destroying all these people. Now, were people sniffing around? Did anybody ever come across this woman as, you know, hey, I was going by this home, 4 miles away or in another state. And I swore I could have seen, I swore I saw your daughter there. I mean, was that ever happening? Were people becoming aware of the children she had stolen?
I think people were becoming aware in the mid-40s. But I don't know that anyone ever saw a child. You know, a lot of times she would try to get the children out of town, for one thing. And another thing was, I cannot overstate the amount of lies she told in these reports. And so I think people began to suspect. And then the way that it all transpired, that it came to an end for her, was she was in very tight with a guy named Boss Crump. He was a political leader, and he had control of the Memphis area and of much of Tennessee. And she was in cahoots with him, basically. I guess you would say, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, in a cliche. And so when a new governor was elected, then at that time, the political machine began to crumble. And so Browning was the new governor, and he wanted this investigated. And this is, this just shows you how the tentacles of this, as you mentioned earlier, were so tied into so many people. So the governor, Browning, hires a lawyer, a man named Robert Taylor, to do an extensive investigation. And you can look at that report. It's a public document, and I have a copy actually right here with me right now. And this report was unbelievable about everything that Georgia Tan was doing. And that's when the first part of the report came out in the fall, about September of 1950. And that's when her empire began to crumble. By then, the true investigation had been done, and it went on, and the actual final report, I think, came out the next, in the spring, June of the next year, 51. And so that's how it all came to an end. To me, and Lisa Wingate, who wrote Before We Were Yours and is my co-author on Before and After, she said, she likes to say, if this were fiction, you could make up an ending that is really satisfying where justice is done. And I told her, I said, that would be like they're in a courtroom and these kids get to come in and look at her and their parents. She has to face them. But, and this to me is so suspicious and just a little too coincidental, she was at home, supposedly ovarian cancer is her cause of death, which we think is very ironic. And she died at home right as the report was coming out. And I was a journalist for many years, and I have to say, I thought that is just a little too odd. And I even went and got her death certificate. However, I'm not trying to start some big conspiracy theory, but I will say that as many documents as were forged, I suppose that could have been forged too. But it is a little odd that she died at home of cancer right as all this is, breaking.
Do you, going down the conspiratorial avenue, is there any chance that maybe she faked her death? Because there were too many people that, the government and people involved would have helped, I would have guessed, because she was passing these things right underneath people's noses.
Yeah, I mean, I have no way of knowing that, and I don't tend in life to be a conspiracy theorist, but I will just say that I also don't believe in coincidences. And, the novelist, because I've written some novels too, and the novelist in me wonders, like, is there a parallel universe? You write a story where she went on to live the rest of her life somewhere. Another interesting thing is that she lived a very lavish lifestyle. She had big parties. Very important people came to them. She owned over in Mississippi, she owned a plantation with horses because she had to go over there and ride because her work was so stressful. She owned a place at the beach. And so when she died, none of the money went to the Tennessee Children's Home Society. It went to her. It's a kind of an unusual circumstance. She adopted a woman who apparently I don't know how old she was when she adopted her, but who was her partner. And she left money to her, and they adopted a daughter, and to the daughter. So in her will.
All right. Now we've heard George's story. She dies just as everything's kind of coming to a head, which, again, karma, justice, who knows? I mean, look, you could say timing is pretty bizarre, you know. Listen, you know, Charles Schulz turned in his last Peanuts cartoon the day it ran, he died.
Yeah.
David Bowie released an album the same day he died. So you could look at some of these deals, and it's kind of like, you know, my job here is done. She was sick. She just gave up because she knew what was coming her way. You know, yeah,
that's a really good point, actually, that, you know, because clearly she knew she was under investigation, that Crump was no longer in power, that Browning was. Yeah. So that's true.
Yeah. I mean, that would be part of it. Now, talk to me about some of the success and happy stories that have come from this. Families, I mean, 5,000 kids stolen. How many kids have come forward now to believe that they were part of this circuit?
Well, you know, I don't have a number on that, actually. And the hard thing is knowing how many are still living. But we are hearing from more and more. And I can tell you some wonderful stories. And in before and after, for example, I love all these stories, and I love these people. They are really heroes. Georgia Tan she's an evil villain, but she does not get to own their stories. They own their stories. They've come forward. They've told them. And I love that. And you know this from your work. There is so much power in owning and telling our stories and in listening to people's stories. And so here's a great one for you. So there's a woman who has all her life, she was adopted she was sent up to New York. This was very common that people would be sent to New York, and they were often sent to Jewish families because, again, this was after the Holocaust. There were people in Memphis who wanted to help kind of repopulate Jewish families, and because of anti-Semitism, they might not be able to adopt. So Georgia Tan would make up these elaborate backstories on people. And here's one. This woman, one of the first women I went to visit, she's in her 70s, and she's never really been that interested in talking about this until she read Before We Were Yours, the novel. And she was born to a poor Christian mother. I mean, the mother was a Christian background. But her mother could not take care of her, didn't have enough money. So she put her in, you know, Georgia Tan's care. And Georgia Tan then sent this child, but she was 14 months old when she was sent, to a family up in New York, a Jewish family. And so Georgia Tan, and I have all of this in writing from the Tennessee Children's Home Society, made up this elaborate story, Dave, about this woman, about how she was born to a Jewish med school father. He was in med school. His wife, the young mother, died in a car accident. the grandparents owned a haberdashery shop and just were too old to take care of this cute Jewish baby. So the baby needed to be adopted by a Jewish family. Well, that was all lies. Now, this woman doesn't know this. She goes, she's raised by this wonderful family. She had a wonderful upbringing. She adored her adoptive parents. But she always, and they were much older, by the way, like other parents, other Georgetown adoptive parents, she always felt like something was missing. These people, I don't know if it's intuition, if it's some sort of what it is, but these people often, adoptees that who I interviewed, just felt like something was missing. And so she winds up much later in life finding her sisters who were living out west, and she had a wonderful reunion with them. And she said when she met, oh, this woman is just a delight. When she met her sisters, she said, I looked at one of my sister's hands and I was looking at my own hand. She said it was just such an amazing experience. So that, you know, is an example of how people reclaim their lives. But I have to tell you this great story. You mentioned you have 11 children. So there's a woman who was looking, and she finally found three siblings, but she knew all her life she had wanted a sibling. Her parents were older, and she, when she would play with her dolls, she would pretend like her dolls were her brothers and sisters. So she finds out that she has three siblings, and she finds them. She finds two of them, I'm sorry, but one of them she cannot find because he didn't technically go through the orphanage. He was actually bought at a drugstore, I believe, in Tennessee from somebody. And so her grandson was 16 at the time. He's 18 now and in college. He loves his grandmother. They have a great relationship. So he asked for Ancestry.com for Christmas. And his mother said, oh, you know, let's wait till it goes on sale in the spring. So they waited. It went on. These folks live up in the Northeast. And so he went on Ancestry, did his DNA, and he got a question from a woman who said, you're showing up as a cousin of mine. And is there any chance, you know, we're trying to figure out how you're related. And so this boy, very smart boy, says, well, my grandmother's adopted. Is your father adopted? And he had found her long lost brother. That was only about 2 years ago. This man's in his 80s. I've interviewed him. I've visited with him. And he is so happy that they have connected. It is unbelievable. We just had a big gathering, Lisa and I, down in Memphis when the book came out. And we got together with a lot of these folks came for a gathering. Oh, we had such a great time sharing stories. And they were there, this brother and sister. And seeing them together is just, oh my gosh, it'll bring tears to your eyes. And there are a lot of really heartwarming stories like that. You know what's interesting? I think sometimes we just take our families for granted. And these people, when they connect, they really love and adore their families.
It's beautiful that people have been able to find each other and that even through all of this, there is some closure.
Right. Oh, there is. And I'll tell you something else that is really, I think I knew this at some level. I've been a journalist and an author for many years, but one thing that has really made me so happy is how telling their stories really has helped heal them. And that to me is really, you know, just amazing. And it also, there are so many people in this group who we have come to be close to who are helping each other now find other clues and find people. We were with a woman in Memphis who went from our gathering to meet her half sister for the first time. And, you know, there are a lot of really heartening things about that and about just, you know, not letting again this evil Georgia Tan take over your life. And in before and after, one thing, I mean, we really did not want it to be all about Georgia Tan.
Right. Yeah. Not, unfortunately, though, it is her story and how she affected so many people. But it's powerful to hear that, you know, we cover crime on the show every week, and it's just powerful to hear how people are so willing to be a part of even a machine of evil like this for just money, that they could be sold out so easily. Mm-hmm. But again, it's the 20s through the 50s, right? There was probably, it was a different time. People were struggling to make ends meet. Helping out in any way, shape, or form might have been the difference between putting food on the plates of their own family or not, right? And not that I'm saying it's okay what people did, but I just, you know, I mean, you got to take a look at it through the eyes of who were her compatriots during all of this.
Right. And, you know, don't you think, too, that one man told me, he said, you know, the man whose parents were told that their baby died, he said, my parents, that was an era when if a doctor told you something or a nurse, any authority figure, you believed it. So I do think there is some of that to it, you know, a different way of, you know, people didn't have instant access to information the way we do now. And I think we did probably, you know, people did have a respect for authority that I don't know if the same level exists today. So, you know, I think that's true. One thing that's fascinating, though, is how many people are out there who really were touched. You mentioned, you know, how long this went on. Think about this. So if you have 5,000, and we believe there were more because some of the people we've interviewed, they were given a number when they went into the Georgia TAN system. And some of them have numbers that are up to nearly 7,000. So you have to believe that there were 7,000, although some of those did die. But it's kind of fascinating now to think about future generations, because this DNA, now their DNA spreads out to future generations. And so you take the 5,000 and then you think of those who've had children and grandchildren and now great-grandchildren. And so the Georgia TAN legacy will definitely live on. The great thing is, of course, that these people, many of them are, they're just fine people, and they are, you know, their legacy lives on in their kids too, obviously. But these kids want to know. I mean, grandkids want to know because they need to know for medical reasons. Like people told me a lot of stories about, I go to the doctor and I sit down and they want my medical history. I have no idea. And a lot of people began searching for relatives, but when there was some health issue that they needed to know more about.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I don't know my biological father. I mean, I know where he is now. We tracked him down when I was in my 20s. Not a good human being. But I did find my brother, and my brother and I are close. Okay. So, you know, we ended up connecting, I want to say 17 years ago. And we've been, you know, friends and close since then. So it's nice that those connections. But I understand that you look yourself in the mirror and you think, where does this come from? Who do I look like? Where, you know, there's just always this little spot of emptiness in you.
I think that's really true. And you have a personal insight into that. The people who I interviewed, Dave, really did feel that. And one thing that almost all of them said was, I would be walking down a street and I would think, is that person related to me? Do I look like that person? Like, I interviewed a woman who had been adopted, and she was one of the so-called Jewish babies. She was adopted by a Jewish family. And she told me that she said, until I went, she eventually connected with her birth mother, although they did not have a deep relationship. Her birth mother wanted her to come. When the birth mother died, she wanted this daughter at the funeral. And the daughter said, when I walked into that funeral, for the first time in my life, I saw people who look like me. And I think there's a lot to that. You know, we live in a real disconnected age in many ways. You know, you can get online and be anybody, social media, all these things. And I really do believe that people yearn for connection, and that a lot of the stories in before and after are about how people persisted until they made these connections.
Well, thank you for being a part of the resolution for many people and putting this book together. I, again, I state this often, folks, but I want you to know, I mean, really, this is just the tip of the iceberg. The book is so much more in depth, and we do have a link up to it on today's program, so you can click the link and order the book.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Certainly.
I love talking about it. And again, I just love these people so much. It's, you know, when you listen and tell somebody's story, you do this all the time for a living. You really get to know them. And these are really, you know, they're really remarkable people who have great stories to tell.
Yes, they do. And again, thank you for facilitating those stories and keeping them alive. Speaking of stories, Tim, we've got a few to talk about this week. We've got more Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News Storytime.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, so before we go directly into Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, I did ask a couple of questions last week, and I asked people to weigh in on it. And I got a couple of messages here. Hey, darling Dave and terrific Tim. That's us, by the way.
Oh, Tim. All right, then.
Longtime listener for 9 years, listening to the True Crime Tuesday from December 3rd on the Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals segment, you asked about mind-boggling, scary bus drivers. My younger two children, both girls, one in middle school, the other in elementary, both have the same bus driver. My middle schooler goes to school earlier and is out earlier than my daughter in elementary school. Okay, that is out of the way. This is the bus driver's first year on this route, and I haven't cared much for her since day one. She's never consistent with time. Some days very early, some very late, and randomly right on time. She literally moved a bus stop from my driveway to one two doors down, only for the elementary school kids, not the middle school ones. She has stopped at the gas station and had students pick up her stuff at the convenience store en route to the school. She is rude to the kids, except a select few. All that I can get past, just get my kids to and from the school safely. Well, one day, my middle school daughter calls me and says, Miss X is texting and driving the bus. Whoa, excuse me. Is this for real? All my thoughts. Told my daughter, I'm sorry, this is kind of choppy the way it's written. All my thoughts, told my daughter to record this. She gets home and I review the two recordings she's taken. The first, the bus driver is very clearly texting on her cell while driving a busload of kids home while the bus is in motion. No. Bad, very bad. The second video shows her doing the same thing, coming up to an intersection to turn left into the neighborhood. She glances up, sees someone walking on the sidewalk in the opposite direction. She is still holding her phone mid-text and completely turns around in her seat and is looking at the person walking and then at her phone. This woman is coming to a red light, holding her phone mid-text, turning around, looking at a person walking the opposite direction. Holy shit. That's what she says. I immediately called the middle school and unleashed my rage, but in a very diplomatic mama sort of way. Mm-hmm. I do have to show my girls how to get their point across without shooting off their mouth. The principal was appalled. We emailed the videos to the school and waited. When it was time for my youngest to get off the bus, she skips our new bus stop completely, and I walk down to collect my child from the end of the street. I call the elementary school, let them know what the goings on. Next day, Miss X is not driving the bus, and the neighbors and I are pleased and think we will be getting a new bus driver. Nope. 2 weeks later, this woman is back and has our children's lives in her hands. No amount of complaining has yet to change this. It's been 2 months. When I was going, the high school students who drive us were better than this lady. It just astounds me that she still has a job with the public school system. Well, I suppose it could be worse. She could have been drinking and driving the kids. But to me, the cell phone is just as dangerous while driving as being under the influence. Thank you, too, for all your wonderful shows. the ones that make you laugh, the ones that have made me cry, and the ones that are just plain old creepy. They're all good, and the two of you are a dynamic duo who do a wonderful job. That's from Augusta, Georgia, with love. There's going to be a few pauses, folks, because I am fighting this stupid man flu, and the coughs keep grabbing a hold of my lungs and forcing their way out, Tim. They're beating me. Hi, Dave and Tim. Here's my explanation why women marry men in prison who have been convicted of murder and or murder of their spouse.
Okay.
Many women go into relationships thinking they can change the guys. Why do many women ignore the nice guys and go after the edgy guy? They feel that they can be the one to change them and rescue or tame them. The prison scenario is an extreme version of this. No, I don't get it either. I love TCT.
Oh,
or maybe, yeah. Maybe she lives for TCT. Could Dave be. And Tim, you are such good interviewers, and I love Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. You guys are awesome. Allison in Rhode Island.
Oh, all right.
Yep. So we got that going for us.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a really long story here. I'm not going to read because I'll cough my brains out through it. Oh. I'll just give you the ups and downs of it.
Sure.
Accused of killing a Gambino mob boss. The killer is presenting a novel defense, Tim.
Okay.
4 days after pulling off the most high-profile mob killing in decades, Anthony Camello sat down with New York Police Department detectives and told them that the CIA had infiltrated the mafia, and he added that the government was spying on him. He had put his phone in a copper bag to protect it from, quote-unquote, satellites, Tim. He told them, and Democratic operatives in Washington were doing business with Joaquin Guzman Loria?
Joaquin Guzman.
L-O-E-R-A. Laura?
Lori?
The Mexican drug kingpin known as El Chapo.
Ah, yes.
We could have just gone straight to El Chapo. We didn't have to give his full damn legal name, you morons. Writing an article with too much information. In the 9 months since that conversation, Mr. Camello, age 25, has claimed to his lawyer that he killed Francisco Cali because the mob boss was part of the deep state, a member of the liberal cabal working to undermine President Trump, Tim. At one court appearance, Mr. Camello scrawled on his hand a symbol and phrases associated with the far-right conspiracy theory, QAnon. Did I say that right? QAnon?
Either that or it's Narcotics Anonymous. I have no idea.
Yeah. Now, Mr. Camello's paranoia is being litigated in a Staten Island court where he is charged with the murder of Mr. Cali, known as Frankie Boy. His lawyer has taken the first steps in a legal battle that hinges on a question made for the internet age. At what point does belief in the far-right conspiracy theory make you legally insane? The crime's three major components, an aimless drifter from Staten Island, the underboss of the Gambino crime family, and a far-right internet conspiracy theory collided on a dark street in Todd Hill, has perplexed law enforcement officials and mob watchers alike, which would make me start to think, Tim, maybe there is something to this claim. Because if it seems implausible that all of these things would come together to create this, maybe that's because there are some strings that are being pulled.
Possibly.
Tim?
Yeah.
From the great state of Minnesota.
Okay.
A 6-foot-tall Grinch decoration has vanished from an Apple Valley yard.
I saw this story the other night, yeah.
An Apple Valley Grinch got Grinched as a nearly 6-foot-tall Grinch Christmas decoration stolen from a man's yard in Apple Valley, Minnesota. The owner, Josh Stroman, made the Grinch decoration himself, and it was quite the display in the Apple Valley neighborhood. People would stop by to take pictures of it, but now, Tim, now it's gone.
Uh-huh.
Stroman filed a police report, and he's hoping that whoever took off with the Grinch may have some remorse and come forward. Stroman says every year he places the Grinch in a different spot on his front yard for all to see. He put it out on Thanksgiving night, and by Sunday morning, he noticed it was gone. He assumes someone put it in a vehicle and took off with it because it's very, very heavy. Either way, he wants it back. It's sad. that it's the world we live in today that you can't even have holiday decorations out to celebrate, Stroman said. Stroman's just not seeing the irony of it, Tim. What did the Grinch do? He snuck into town and stole all the Christmas decorations.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think it's a beautiful show of irony.
It really is, yeah.
A man drives a stolen SUV, Tim, to bail his brother out of jail for stealing an SUV. The immortal words of Tears for Fears, Tim, people are people.
I don't think that was Tears for Fears.
Should have been.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Who sings that song? No, that's Tears for Fears.
Mm-mm.
People are people. Why should it seem you and I should get along so awfully? I can't remember the rest. I'm in a cloud of NyQuil. That's a Tears for Fears song.
No.
It is.
Nope. What do you want to? Is this a Double or Nothing McRib thing?
They don't make them anymore out here. I can't even find them.
You didn't try in the first place.
No, I really did. There really wasn't. I couldn't locate any stupid locations that had. It was like an 8-hour drive, and that was Depeche Mode. People are people.
Yeah, people are people.
So I tried to tell you, Tim. Depeche Mode. I'm pretty sure Depeche Mode and Tears for Fears are the same guys.
They
Depeche
are not.
Mode is just their superhero costumes.
Yeah, they're not. They're not the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I prefer Depeche a la Mode, to be honest.
I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Jackson County, Kansas. It was not the 2-for-1 Black Friday special authorities in Northeast Kansas were expecting, Tim. They caught two Topeka brothers driving stolen vehicles just hours apart. A Jackson County, Kansas sheriff's deputy stopped a stolen car near Mayetta. Sheriff Tim Morris says the car was stolen and Eric McCracken was arrested. Yeah.
He has a brother, Phil, standing by somewhere.
Yeah. Well, in prison he does. Phil McCracken is probably his nickname. His baby doll name. A few hours later, an off-duty officer was told about a stolen car driving into Holton, Kansas. The driver drove through yards before stopping behind an old grocery store and running away. Keith McCracken was eventually found by a police dog and arrested for driving a stolen vehicle. It's believed that the younger McCracken was en route to the Jackson County Jail to post bail on his older brother in the stolen vehicle. Both brothers are also facing related charges, including license violations and running from police, Tim. Just like that song, I Ran,
mm-hmm.
by Wham, Tim.
I don't think Wham did I Ran either.
What?
No, yeah.
What?
Yeah, that wasn't...
Was that Depeche Mode? Sorry, Depeche
no,
Mode.
No, it wasn't.
Just not giving enough credit.
It wasn't Depeche Mode either. No.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Foggy, Tim, that's all I can say.
No, Foggy didn't do it either.
Foghat bystanders in Arizona, Tim, jumped to the aid of a woman in a wheelchair as a man tried to steal that wheelchair while the woman was still sitting in it. We're going to Phoenix, Arizona, all the way to Tacoma, Tim. He was wearing red reindeer slippers, but he was not showing holiday spirit. An Arizona man was caught on camera pushing a woman out of her wheelchair and then running away with it.
No.
Bystanders stepped in to stop him and get the wheelchair back. The incident happened on Arizona's light rail. Suspect Austin Charbot was arrested days later after police said thousands helped share his photo online. Phoenix police said he had two outstanding warrants and now faces 5 new charges, including robbery, kidnapping, and assault.
Yeah, that's about right.
What kind of shit are you that you would push a human being out of a wheelchair to steal it?
Takes all kinds, Dave.
A woman has been arrested for DUI after her RV gets stuck going in through the outdoor, Tim.
Ooh.
In through the outdoor at a Taco Bell drive-thru. We're going to Kennewick, Washington. Police arrested a woman on suspicion of DUI after she got her RV stuck in a Washington State Taco Bell drive-thru. According to the Kennewick Police Department, the woman drove the wrong way into the fast food restaurant drive-thru shortly after midnight on Friday, Tim.
Oof.
A Okay, so is it going to be alcohol or drugs, Tim? We haven't gotten to that point yet, so it's still open for debate.
I'm going for the good old-fashioned drink here, Dave.
You think alcohol, RV, Taco Bell all come together?
Yep.
Because meth is also, you know, you're a long driver in those RVs late nights. Meth might be it. Let's find out, shall we?
Sure.
The RV couldn't make the turn and got stuck at the corner of the building. Officers said they suspected the 56-year-old of driving under the influence. She was booked into Benton County Jail. Oh, they just leave us hanging, Tim.
Oh.
Under the influence. They're not telling us if it's under the influence of the alcohol or the drugs.
That sounds like one too many margaritas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she should add one more.
Yep.
here's a headline. You know, sometimes, Tim, you do the show long enough, you think there's not a headline left that would surprise me.
Okay.
And then you get, you get this one. Filipino man decapitates woman, eats her brain because she spoke English to him. Yeah, 21-year-old Filipino man decapitated a woman because she spoke English to him. Not only did he kill her, he went on to use her brains as topping on some rice and ate it all. Lloyd Bagtong, 21, was arrested Thursday on the island of Mindanao. The British newspaper The Daily Mail reports the woman approached him early in the morning when he was drunk and hungry. Oh, God, he was drungry? Drangry? How do you say that? When you're hungry and angry, you're hangry. When you're drunk and hungry and angry, are you drangry?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Yep.
All because she spoke to him in English. He decided to use a garden tool to decapitate her.
Oh.
Well, that is the chosen tool of all good decapitators, Tim.
No, it isn't, Dave.
Next, he used a piece of cloth to wrap her head in and carry it home. You know, he's a good hunter, Tim. At least he eats his kill. It's not just a thrill kill. Ugh. So gross.
Okay. I'm wondering how far of a walk this is that he's just going to wrap it up, take it home with him.
I don't know. He used a piece of cloth to wrap her head in and carry it home. Once he took out the brains in order to eat them, he just threw the skull in a hole nearby his house. I got to guess this probably isn't the first time this guy's done this, Tim.
Probably not.
He had to get that hankering for brains somehow.
Ugh.
And I'm going to guess. I don't know. I haven't gone any further in the story. But I got to guess this is not his first brain rodeo. Gray Matter Rodeo. Maybe that's the way to... Ooh, that'd be a good band name, don't you think? Gray Matter Rodeo?
It is a good name for a band, yeah.
Yeah. The woman, meanwhile, was found topless with her hands tied behind her back. Goes without saying that she truly suffered a horrific fate. She must have been fully aware what was happening when Bagtong killed her. Oh.
Oh.
The murderer has been sent for psychiatric evaluation. Save your money. He's crazy.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm just Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law, with my partner Tim Dennis, defense attorney at law. But I'm going to go on the record as saying he's crazy, Tim. Mm-hmm. Psychiatric evaluation be damned. He's a cuckoo in the nut. Which is, I think that's Latin for crazy.
We got a saying in Anoka County, nuttier than a squirrel turd.
Oh.
Yeah.
Police, meanwhile, are trying to identify the victim's body. They're urging those with missing loved ones or relatives to contact them. As a classical liberal, I'm opposed to the death penalty, this article says. We don't need to go into this person's blatherings. The rest of the story was interesting enough.
Yeah.
All right, our final story is heartbreaking. I don't even know that this is, well, it's obviously dumb and stupid. The Flay, WFLA, reports a Haines City man in Florida was arrested Sunday for reportedly dropping off a child on the side of the road because, well, he thought the kid was gay.
What?
Yeah, Haines City Police Department arrested 30-year-old Evanaud Julamuli. Oh, my God. Evanaud. E-V-E-N-A-U-D. Is that right? Evanaud?
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 Evanod, something like that.
Last name, J-U-L-M-E-U-S, Julmus, Julmius, Evanod Julmius. It sounds like a Christmas carol in Latin, doesn't it? Sunday evening, after finding the boy under 18 years old outside the police station crying and holding a duffel bag with several clothes inside, the officer asked the boy what was wrong. The child told the officer, Julmulius kicked him out of the house because he thinks he's gay. The police report does not specify the exact relationship between Julmulius and the boy. The boy told the officer that after a verbal argument over the issue, Julmulius told him to pack his bags and get in the car. Julmulius then drove the boy to a turn lane on Highway 27 near the Haines City Police Department. The boy said Julmulius ordered him to get out and said, police will find you a new home, boy.
Wow.
After the boy got out of the car, Julmulius returned home. Police department said the boy was left at the police station without food, water, money, or a phone. A bystander at the police station saw the whole thing happen and reported the incident. The report states that when the boy's mother asked Julmulius where the boy was, Julmulius told her what happened and that if she wanted to go get him, he's at the police department. The woman then left the house to go find her son. Julmulius was arrested and charged with child neglect. I thought, okay, hear me out on this, Tim.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
First of all, I thought if you take a kid to a police department or fire department, they'll take the kid, no questions asked, and you don't get punished.
I thought that was an infant, not a full-blown grown child.
Well, we don't know how old the kid is. But I thought that's – I would think that's okay anyway. Here's why. Hear me out.
Okay.
Because I would rather this psychopath jagoff would take this kid and leave him in the custody of the police, then drive him out and throw him into the Everglades, or drop him off in a seedy part of town, or take things into his own hands because he doesn't like the fact that the kid may be gay. So to me, I'm going to give the guy credit that at least he kicked him out and dropped him off at the police station. I'm not saying he's right, and I'm not standing up for the guy, but if you're going to do something dumbass, at least he took the kid to the best place you could take him.
Or did he? I mean,
maybe the other rule is you have to be the biological parent to drop him off.
Yeah.
I get the feeling the woman's like, hey, where's my son?
Yeah. Eh,
they dropped him off at the cop shop. You can go get him if you want, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a little remorse there at the end? All right. You can go back and get him.
Yeah. Yeah. I would think you would have to be the biological custodian or custodial parent in order to make that move.
Makes sense, because otherwise everybody that's come into contact with a Schrader child at one point would have probably dropped them off at a police station by now.
I'm guessing.
Love my kids, Tim, but they can test the constitution of the strongest person.
I would say maybe Nate would be the exception. But otherwise,
Nate?
Yeah.
Oh, Kayla, Nathan, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the rest are crazy. Save me, Tim. Send police. I need help. Prisoner at Mount Home. Proof that they're trying to kill me, they continue to bring home new diseases that try to eat me, Tim, and destroy me.
I don't get why.
They hate me, obviously. Huh. It's the only thing I can understand. I hope that's not the case. No, they're good kids. I love my children. I just wish they'd stop bringing diseases home. So I got all of my seven kids still in school in seven different schools. And then my son is dating a girl who goes to another school and works at a daycare. So she's double dipping.
Wow.
Yeah. Into the old bacteria font and bringing me a helping of what she's got, too.
That's not a Petri dish. That's like a Petri below ground pool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Well, that's it for this week, kids. We're done with our dumb crime, stupid criminals. We hope you enjoyed today's program. Remember that the link to the book is found right in today's posting. You can also go to darknessradio.com, click on the store tab. When you're there, you'll see our Amazon store link. Click it, and it'll take you in. You can find books that we talk about on the paranormal side, the books we talk about on the true crime side. Also, a whole bunch of cool gift ideas. And this is what I'm going to ask you. Even if you look through and there's nothing you want to buy, but you know you want to get some stuff through Amazon, as long as you go in through our link and place orders, it'll still count as part of our little affiliate program. Doesn't cost you anything extra, and it lines my pockets with your copper. More pennies in my pocket. That's what I'm all about this holiday season. more pennies in my pocket. So if you're going to go make a purchase, please go make a purchase through our Amazon shop and bookmark it. So every purchase you make, you go through that shop. Just do it. It's the right thing to do, folks, especially if you want to buy furniture, expensive gold and silver, children, anything that's really high priced on Amazon. Do they sell kids on Amazon, Tim?
I believe so, yeah.
Put mine up for there and see what I can get for them.
Yeah, why not?
It's a good idea. I'm still going to give you a first shot if you want one.
You know, I think I'm good.
All right. Well, that's it. We'll be back again next week. Remember to tune in this weekend for more of the best in paranormal talk radio as Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis take you deep into the darkness, beyond the darkness, every Saturday and Sunday. You can find more information about that show and my other program, Midnight in the Desert, the best in anomalous talk radio. You can find the information on all these programs and the Holzer files. All of it can be found right at darknessradio.com. And don't forget, folks, this is the season finale of the Holzer Files, season one finale this Thursday, the Barnstable House in Massachusetts, one of my favorite stories, and it is a really interesting, fascinating mystery that unfurls. So make sure you tune in and check that out this Thursday. Help us go out on a high note for our season finale of the Holzer Files on Travel Channel. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. Okay.